China and Russia have signed contracts with Iraq's national oil company.
Dead men love war. They sit astride the icy bones of their murdered horses, grinning.
Think of New York City attacked by not just two airplanes, but by 1,500 missiles. At least 31 of these will be hitting your city each hour for 2 days.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Monday, March 10th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. French President Jacques Chirac said today France would use its UN Security Council veto to block a resolution authorizing war against Iraq. Whatever happens, France will vote no, said Chirac. Both Hans Blix and Mohamed El-Baradei's politely suggested in their reports that at least one of the, or rather some of the allegations made by the Bush administration regarding Iraq's weapons of mass destruction have not panned out. And an article in the San Francisco Chronicle states that a company owned by Vice President Dick Cheney's former company Halliburton has landed the government contracts to advise the administration on rebuilding the oil fields if we launch an invasion into Iraq. The contract is marked classified information. Edward Epstein is a reporter for the Chronicle, which broke the story. He explained to Peace Watch earlier that the details of the contract are being protected by the Pentagon.
We don't know how lucrative it is because it's classified information. All we know is that there is a contract. They won't release, the Pentagon will not release the amount of the contract or how it was awarded. If it was through competitive bidding or what process was followed.
So it's still classified information, but at the same time, this information was actually stated in a Defense Department document, was it not?
Yes, they issued a statement about starting to plan for how to handle the oil fields after a war in Iraq, especially if Saddam Hussein tried to destroy the oil fields like he did in Kuwait after the 1991 war.
Like he allegedly did in Kuwait after the 1991 war.
As far as I know, he burned 700 or 900 oil wells.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've heard reports from U.S. soldiers, actually, who said they lit those oil wells. Moving right along.
And the last paragraph of this document says that this contract has gone to Brown & Root Services, which is a unit of Kellogg Brown & Root, which in turn is owned by Halliburton of Houston, Texas, where Dick Cheney was chairman until the 2000 campaign.
And so this company, Kellogg Brown & Root Services, has already been hired to...
Yes, they've already prepared a plan on outlining how these problems would be handled.
Any intelligent guess or estimate as to how much money is potentially available here?
Well, for the plan, it's a small contract, but in terms of if the oil fields, existing ones, were set afire, I've seen $3 to $4 billion to repair those. Of course, many companies would bid on that work. And Iraq's oil fields have been declining for years since Saddam came to power, actually, since he invaded Iran. And I've seen estimates of $50 billion investment needed to get the production just back up to what it was before he came to power in 1979.
Did you find it at all surprising, Edward Epstein, that this information was just sort of readily available in a Defense Department document? What about conflict of interest?
Well, that's the reason I and others did the story. It gives the appearance, of course, to those people who think that the war is about oil. It gives credence to that, that this is just about making profits for Halliburton and other companies. It can certainly feed that suspicion.
Yeah,
of course, the vice president would say that he's been gone from Halliburton for many years, and I believe he sold his shares in the company, didn't he? Or they're in a blind trust, either one, I'm not sure, but that he has nothing to do with Halliburton and hasn't for years.
Well, I was going to ask you that. One could argue that Cheney is no longer affiliated with Halliburton, but, you know, that he possibly was made to divest himself and his interest upon entering the office of vice presidency. But I don't know, is that part of your beat? I mean, would you have covered perhaps other stories of this nature? Do you know if it's really possible to continue to have, to hide money in those type of instances? Is it possible that...
Well, Brown & Root is a big government contractor because it does this kind of work, and it does international construction work. I would guess it's had tens of millions of dollars of contracts with the Pentagon and other government agencies over the past decade.
Mm-hmm. I guess the question, though, is it reasonable for us to expect that, yes, Vice President Dick Cheney could well have, separated himself from that that company and all the and all his financial holdings there?
Well, those who support the president will say, sure, the president and George Bush and Condoleezza Rice, who was a director of what's now Chevron Texaco, they're not doing this because of oil. But people who suspect that this war is really about the control of Iraqi oil fields will take this contract, this fact, and say, aha, here's a bit of proof that that's what this is all about. So, you know, when I wrote this story, I've been getting emails from people on both sides of the issue praising me or attacking me for writing the story. I just found it very interesting that this company that has been associated with the vice president got this very interesting little contract to do a bit of war planning.
So those who are praising you, what are they saying?
They say the war is about oil, and this just proves it to them. And those who say it's not about oil say, you know, why would you write this thing? Cheney has not had anything to do with Halliburton for several years, and it's really unfair to paint him with this. But as I said, I just found it very interesting that his firm got this contract.
Mm-hmm. Were you able to do any kind of research or investigation into the other firms that...
Well, there aren't many companies that do this kind of work. That's another factor that could do it on this scale. There's Bechtel in San Francisco. You remember Red Adair, the guy from, I believe he was from Oklahoma, was a kind of a swashbuckling oil well fighter. He went to Kuwait after 1991. There's another company with a rather funny name in Houston called Boots and Coots that puts out oil well fires.
Mm-hmm.
And Schlumberger does it. And then it goes beyond the fire possibility to building new refineries, helping to dig wells. There's supposedly Iraq's oil capacity or its reserves are much greater than have been proven. So there will be a lot of work to expand the oil industry there.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the other factor is that companies from France, China, and Russia have signed contracts with Iraq's national oil company, leading to charges from people within the administration and others. That you see, that's why they're voting against the war in Iraq, because they don't want their contracts upset. They don't want to endanger Iraq's oil industry. They're just voting with their pocketbooks.
Mm.
But I spoke to some professors about the issue of whether, let's say, the United States invaded Iraq and overthrew Saddam, could the United States just abrogate those contracts that were signed with Saddam Hussein's government? Or could a successor Iraqi government just abrogate it? And the professor said, boy, you'd end up in court for years on a case like that. That's very, would be a bad, risky legal proposition to do that.
San Francisco Chronicle reporter Edward Epstein. Tomorrow, the leader of Turkey's ruling Islamic AK Party, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, will be sworn into parliament, having been elected as a deputy from the southeastern city of Sirte. By Thursday, he will likely be the prime minister. After he becomes prime minister, Erdogan will likely submit a new resolution to the parliament authorizing the United States to launch a northern front for its war on Iraq from Turkish soil. All of this only a week after the Turkish parliament narrowly voted against the war, while more than 100,000 Turks staged a peace protest on the streets of the Turkish capital. Saturday was the first demonstration against the war in Ankara since the vote. Ezi Sarıtepe was there and files this report.
About 1,000 people turned out in Ankara on Saturday, International Women's Day, for a demonstration against the war. Polls showed 95% of Turks oppose the war, but increasingly Turks are feeling pressured into it. Turkey has been experiencing an economic crisis for almost 2 years, and now Turkish politicians are trying to run the economy with the international credits. Most people believe that Turkey is tied to USA, and because of its economic dependence, it's not free to decide about the war. Member of the Union of Public Workers, Turan Topaloğlu.
Turkey has been tied to the USA since the Marshall Aid in 1946. It wants to become the Little America. It followed policies without honor and personality. Our politicians made policies for the interests of America. The American troops have entered Turkey, although the permission was not given. This is the invasion of my country, and I do not appreciate that. If Turkey opposes U.S. policies, the gun directed towards Iraq will also be directed towards Turkey. Turkish people are under threat as much as Iraqi people.
Last Saturday, on the day of the big demonstration, Turkish Grand National Assembly decided not to permit the American troops to enter Turkey and Turkish troops to enter Iraq. That was a big surprise for the Turkish people, because the Turkish cabinet had already made a deal with USA. However, it cannot be said that the Assembly's decision was the last word on the subject. Despite the rejection, American troops entered Turkey on Thursday. Nurten Karataş from Union of Bureau Workers.
Everybody thinks that Turkey is an independent country since the establishment of the Republic. But I don't think so. Turkey has always been a colonial country, and that has been proven by the American troops coming into Turkey without permission. There is no need for permission. America enters any country whenever it wants to. When we look at the nations that cause terrorists, we said that the biggest terrorist is the USA itself. It's a terrorist because it represses the countries that are already repressed.
Although the reject of the first permission paper gave people a little hope, this hope did not last long. Many people believe a second permission paper will be proposed, and this time around, the assembly will accept it. Nurten Karataş.
The first permission paper must have been positive. There was a scenario written and the AK Party played its role and rejected the permission paper. But the second one will be approved. The USA has already invaded Turkey. This is not something new. With the military camp in Incirlik and Balgat in the middle of Ankara, the US invaded Turkey many years ago.
As the troops entered Turkey this week, the Turkish military explained its view about the war. The chief of the army, General Hilmi Özkök, said that while he sees the parliament as Turkey's ruling body, he personally supports allowing U.S. troops to launch a war on Iraq from Turkish soil. The army carries a great deal of weight in Turkey. It has toppled 3 governments in the last 40 years. The army also played a key role in the neutralization of Turkey's most powerful Islamic prime minister Necmettin Erbakan. Now, many of Erbakan's former followers are members of the ruling AKP. Nergis Demirkaya from Human Rights Association.
We are glad that the first permission paper was rejected. We have made a lot of effort for this in the last 4 months, but the process is not over yet. I guess 10 days after the election, the second permission paper will come. The military approved the event too. It will probably be accepted. I'm sure that our protests have been effective for the rejection of the first one. One of the most unfair wars of history is about to happen. We will do our best to stop it.
Tomorrow, the leader of Turkey's ruling Islamic AK Party, Tayyip Erdoğan, will be sworn into parliament, having been elected as a deputy from the southeastern city of Siirt. By Thursday, he will likely be the prime minister. After he becomes prime minister, Erdoğan will likely submit a new resolution to the parliament authorizing the war. Turkish people are waiting for the second paper. Some hope another mass movement could stop it again. For Pacifica's Peace Watch, I'm Ezgi Sarıtaş in the Turkish capital, Ankara.
Chief Weapons Inspectors Hans Blix and Mohammed El-Baradei reported to the UN Security Council again last week. U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell addressed the council and stated that Iraq had once again failed to uphold the demands of UN Resolution 1441.
We meet today, it seems to me, with one question and one very, very important question before us. Has the Iraqi regime made the fundamental strategic and political decision to comply with the United Nations Security Council resolutions and to rid itself of all of its weapons of mass destruction, all of the infrastructure for the development of weapons of mass destruction? It's a question of intent on the part of the Iraqi leadership. The answer to that question does not come from how many inspectors are present or how much more time should be given or how much more effort should be put into the inspection process. It's not a question of how many unanswered clusters of questions are there, or are there more benchmarks that are needed, or are they enough unresolved issues that have been put forward to be examined and analyzed and conclusions reached about? The answer depends entirely on whether Iraq has made the choice to actively cooperate in every possible way, in every possible manner, in the immediate and complete disarmament of itself of its prohibited weapons. That's what 1441 calls for. Unfortunately, in my judgment, despite some of the progress that has been mentioned, I still find what I've heard this morning a catalog still of non-cooperation.
U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell also speaking before the council last week. French Foreign Minister Dominique de Villepin, he asserted that France's opposition to any resolution calling for the use of force against Iraq.
Significant evidence of real disarmament has now been observed, and that is indeed the key to Resolution 1441. Therefore, I would like solemnly to address a question to this body, and it's the very same question being asked by people all over the world. Why should we now engage in war with Iraq? And I would also like to ask, why smash the instruments that have just proven their effectiveness? Why choose division when our unity and our resolve are leading Iraq to get rid of its weapons of mass destruction? Why should we wish to proceed by force at any price when we can succeed peacefully? War is always an acknowledgement of failure. Let us not resign ourselves to the irreparable. Before making our choice, let us weigh the consequences. Let us measure the effects of our decisions. It is clear to all, in Iraq, we are resolutely moving towards completely eliminating programs of weapons of mass destruction. The method that we have chosen works. The information supplied by Baghdad has been verified by the inspectors and is leading to the elimination of banned ballistic equipment.
French Foreign Minister Dominique de Villepin speaking through a translator. Syrian Minister of Foreign Affairs Farouk al-Shara denied the need for a second UN resolution against Iraq. Al-Shara also expressed concern for the U.S.'s support of Israel's weapons of mass destruction and the possible impact on Palestinians in the areas currently occupied by Israel if war goes forth.
While the inspectors are achieving tangible progress in implementing Security Council Resolution 1441, we believe that any individual or any state can ask why insist on adopting a new resolution allowing the use of military force as if war were the best and not the worst option. In the light of the aforementioned, one cannot but wonder what logic can explain the cooperation of the United States with Israel? What logic allows Israel to possess all kinds of weapons of mass destruction, although it continues to occupy the territories of its neighbors and to threaten them, which is something that runs counter to all bodies of international law. Then given that Security Council Resolution 1441 does not set a time limit for the inspector's work, what then could be the background of the arguments that the time is up and that Iraq had only days left to comply? It is truly ironic, and it is kind of naive to claim that war against Iraq will disclose the undeclared WMDs in Iraq, while inspectors will not be able to find the weapons with all the assurances and the facilities given to them. Contrary to the wisdom that says backing away from a wrong position is a virtue, some believe that the buildup of forces is by itself sufficient to justify war against Iraq and destroy it, because it is incomprehensible and no one who is realistic will accept that these forces would go back to their barracks empty-handed. Is this is the case, are we simply facing a just cause or simply an act of robbery, no more or less? Regardless of the accuracy of arguments advanced internationally on the possible objectives of the American military campaign, be they to control the oil of Iraq or to change the map of the Middle East, the Arabs in particular and the international community in general are very apprehensive. We are gravely concerned over the possible slaughter of the Palestinian people, the demolition of their homes, and their forced transfer when war against Iraq is in full swing. Our apprehensions are well-founded given the developments in the occupied territories since September 11, 2001, and the Security Council must take this into account as soon as we are closer to D-Day, which we really hope we will never get.
Syrian Minister of Foreign Affairs Farouk al-Shara at the UN Security Council last week. Today, the French leader Dominique de Villepin, who has led opposition to U.S. demands for Iraq to be disarmed of its suspected weapons of mass destruction by force, said he believed Russia and China, fellow veto-holding permanent members of the council, were also ready to use their vetoes. Earlier, Russian Foreign Minister Igor Ivanov said Moscow would vote against a new draft UN resolution by the United States, Britain, and Spain, giving Iraq until March 17th to disarm or face war. Last Friday, Code Pink and local activists organized a teach-in on buildings, a just peace and real security. Listen to Women for a Change. Women came from around the world to share with others their struggles for peace and justice. Dr. Rania Masri from the Iraq Action Coalition was the keynote speaker. She urged feminists and peace activists to broaden their analysis of oppression as a way to transform the movement against war with Iraq into global movements for peace and real security.
What is needed for feminists and what is needed for those of us who struggle as female peacemakers is to link the liberation struggle of women to all the other liberation struggles that we fight for. We have to link it to the struggle to be free from economic oppression, the struggle to be free from cultural hegemony, and the struggle to be free from military violence. In no way, shape, or form do I believe one can call themselves a feminist and not be aware of these struggles. And of course, we cannot be a feminist and be in support of any form of violence. And in doing so, I think what's really critical is we connect to each other, not out of charity, but out of solidarity, not giving handouts, but linking hands as equals. And it's quite interesting how there's been talk of the liberation of women in numerous wars that the U.S. government has been manipulating and throwing around. They tried to cloak themselves in the liberation of women when they sent our troops to Afghanistan. Liberation does not come from a rain of bombs or from foreign armies. It comes from empowerment of the people themselves. And now we have the corporate mouthpiece of the U.S. right-wing administration, otherwise known as the network media. They're presenting the war on Iraq as a liberation. They've dropped this attempt as disarmament. They've dropped the attempt for stability. And now they're talking it's for liberation. And some of them have even claimed it's for liberation of Iraqi women. And we tell them quite clearly, do you liberate people by dropping 3,000 bombs and missiles in the first 48 hours of an opening air campaign? That's a bomb every 50 seconds. Is it liberation when you threaten the lives literally of millions, including risking the lives of 1.26 million children under five, according to UNICEF? Is it liberation when the U.S. government wants to drop bombs that have a large amount of depleted uranium, penetrating the floor 100 feet below the surface and including them in cluster bombs? Is it liberation when we send foreign armies to invade and occupy another country? And I wonder if this is what they call liberation. God help us when they start talking about oppression.
Dr. Rania Masri from the Iraq Action Coalition. Dr. Anganya Chatterjee, a professor at the California Institute of Integral Studies, spoke about how the U.S. government has not kept its commitments to nation building and reconstruction following military invasions.
If there is a war, what of the aftermath? After the military withdraws and innocent bodies are shoveled in mass graves, the living will face new wars of poverty, disease, and war and rage. Is the United States able to honor its promises for a better tomorrow in the lands it invades? Let us ask that of the women in Afghanistan today. What about self-determination for the dispossessed in Iraq? Will the United States uphold demands for the Turkish people? We've forgotten about the Turkish people. Remember, those were the very people that supported the United States last time and were left to the slaughterhouse. We've forgotten the Turkish people. What will President Bush's war get America? More hatred. But one thing I want to leave us with is that women's resistance needs to be connected to challenging the very fabric of the nation state. I like that you like that. But nation states, brutalization is the only intervention they seem capable of dreaming. The utilization of women's bodies by the nation state to curtail their freedoms, the utilization of imagination in a way that is twisted, the utilization of history in a way that is convenient. It keeps us bonded, indentured to the state's imagination, not to our own. And I'm not saying that we don't need nation states. We need them. But we radically need to rethink the framework through which they function. Why is human rights beyond national rights? Why is human rights lesser than national rights? So I think to consolidate and in a profusion to generate women's resistance, one would have to link that to actions of thinking a nation state that is just. One would have to think of aligning women's groups in solidarity, horizontal alliances with other groups that are also working for change. One would have to build a movement where we are there to support each other, where the movement can be sustainable, not only in its demands, but in how it conducts itself, in building communities for change, in knowing that we are not alone. I want to say one last remark that the world breaks apart and we must put it together again. We must empower the conscience of people and of women to affirm a global rights and a global commitment to human rights, to livelihood, to enact necessary cultural, religious, and social reforms. We need to mourn the world and we need to hope from despair. We need to make, perhaps today, an extraordinary commitment to justice.
Dr. Anganya Chatterjee, a professor at the California Institute of Integral Studies. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. When we come back, Nobel Peace Prize recipient Dr. Helen Caldicott and author, activist Alice Walker. Back in a moment.